Good morning, everyone. It's Sunday, March 24th. I'm Mark Dent, and you're listening to The Hustle Daily Show. A few weeks ago, Wendy's dropped some major news. The fast food giant said it would be introducing new digital menu boards along with dynamic pricing, which is a concept where prices change based on market forces or demand. Similar to Uber, where sometimes you'll go for a ride and it costs you $20, and then you'll come home on the same ride and it costs you $40. So when Wendy's did this, a lot of criticism happened over the next couple of days. There were a lot of memes involving Bloomberg terminals and stock tickers and even Kendall from Succession. So Wendy's walked it back very quickly. Within just a couple of days of rolling it out, Wendy's said they would not be increasing prices at lunch or dinner when there are a lot of people coming to the restaurant. But is this really going to be the end of dynamic pricing? Is this actually going to be something that we're going to see at Wendy's, other fast food restaurants, grocery stores, perhaps even all over the place? To talk about this subject, I brought on Sahaj Sharda. Sahaj is a law student at Columbia University who's studying monopolies and how antitrust laws can stimulate the economy. For a while, he also led a startup that was devoted to dynamic pricing, and he's the author of The Extinction of the Price Tag, How Dynamic Pricing Can Save You. Sahaj, welcome to The Hustle Daily Show.
Hey, Mark. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, awesome. So I wanted to start out by asking you, early on in your book, you kind of point out how dynamic pricing could potentially be this really amazing thing that could lead to higher profits for companies and also a better deal for customers and even supercharge the economy. How could that happen from dynamic pricing?
Dynamic pricing is a tool like any other. Whether it's good or bad for consumers really depends on the market structure in which it's implemented. And so a really good example is like in a super monopolized market, many people would make the argument that Amazon has a lot of market power in e-commerce. Dynamic pricing and algorithmic pricing can be used in a way that can really extract the maximum amount of money that you're willing to pay at any given moment. And so consumers rightly might take offense to something like that because they feel exploited.
As they certainly did with Wendy's.
Right, exactly. And price gouging and profiteering are often used to describe that narratively. And I think, there's definitely something to that. Essentially, if you unleash algorithmic dynamic pricing, what you're really doing is firms with market power and who have access to information about you as a consumer can really exploit that to their fullest of their ability. And that's quite often, a bad outcome for consumers. Essentially, the prediction I was making in the book is that all the big companies, the ones with market power, will be implementing these dynamic pricing systems, will be using really sophisticated analytics and software to figure out exactly how they can maximize profits. But that also opens up an opportunity for traditional smaller chains to also implement dynamic pricing of their own to undercut the monopolistic firms at any given moment.
Right.
The future I was more talking about was a world in which there's always going to be dynamic discounting, which would actually benefit consumers by always offering them a better deal at any given moment.
Gotcha. And so the concept of dynamic pricing, we tend to think of it as fairly new. We think of Uber. I mean, I think that's what comes to everybody's mind, but it's certainly not new. And we do see dynamic pricing in flights, concerts, sporting events, things like that. But even those are not really new. If you look back to like time immemorial, basically, there was bartering, which you point out is the earliest form of dynamic pricing.
If you think about the narrative of the prototypical market, a bazaar in the third world or something like this, something where there's not a lot of sophisticated analytics on pricing, but it's more bargaining based. Well, essentially what happens there is the price is always flexible. And so you'll go and you'll barter with your counterparty and try and haggle for a better deal. And, tactics we see in those types of prototypical markets is people threaten to leave, to defect to competitors, and, essentially try to put up tough negotiating stances to get better prices for themselves. In the American economy, one of the things that really happened was we had a series of revolutions in our economy. And so with the birth of major retail outlets, think of Sears or, Walmart, companies like this, when you had so much scale, essentially bartering became more inefficient for them. They would rather minimize on the transaction costs of two people going at it and maybe lose some sales, but get the efficiency of setting flat prices over time. The next revolution that's happened, though, that sort of brought us back to that bizarre type world is the cost of computing has gone down dramatically because of Moore's Law. And so the menu costs and the transaction costs have likewise gone down. Now you can have algorithms negotiate on your behalf as a company against consumers. And with digital commerce, you know, the menu cost of switching your prices is essentially zero. And so we've re-entered this sort of older world in a way where it's much more about counterparty negotiating and figuring out the best way to get deals, where people are using plugins on their web browser to try and figure out, you know, when there are sales, where they can get better deals, you know, tools like Expedia and all these information aggregators. This is in large part the value that they provide. And so I think you're exactly right. You know, dynamic pricing, flexible pricing generally is a very, very old phenomenon. It happens all over the world in all sorts of markets. And what we're seeing really is a digital version of that be implemented in the economy today.
When I do go to a bazaar, if I'm visiting like another country, it can sometimes be a frustrating experience, certainly, but the destiny is kind of in your own hands. It could be a mutually beneficial agreement a lot of times.
You know, not all forms of dynamic pricing really hurt you. A good example is, you know, when you're able to get a really cheap flight because no one else is flying during a specific weekend, you know, when it's off season, it feels good as a consumer to be able to do that. If you had essentially flat pricing all of the year, all the time, you wouldn't have those opportunities to get those cheaper flights. And so there are specific instances where dynamic pricing can be really good for consumers. I think the real thing that people are afraid of is the exploitation of market power. We just don't speak about it that way. And so we sort of condemn the tool and not the structural condition.
Yeah. And to be clear, like when people have brought out the idea of dynamic pricing, and not just Wendy's, I mean, it's almost always led to controversy. There's a really specific example that you've brought up, which is Coca-Cola. In 1999, they tried to basically have dynamic pricing by temperature. Can you tell us what that is and what the response was to it?
I think, you know, the Coca-Cola anecdote's a really funny one, where essentially what they were trying to do by pegging prices to temperature is if it's hot, people want a refreshing cold can of Coca-Cola. And so they thought, why don't we exploit this ability for demand spikes by raising our prices? And in so doing, you know, basically maximize our profits. Naturally, consumers who were used to flat and standard pricing felt emotionally like they were being exploited. And again, you know, I think Coca-Cola is a really good example of the dynamic I was talking about earlier. Here you have a firm with a tremendous amount of market power, which has almost monopoly-like market share in this specific market. And so when they do something like dynamic pricing, it really does feel like exploitation because it is very clearly centered around maximizing profits. And so there's massive pushback. Coca-Cola eventually rolled back their plans in doing this, similar, I think, to what's happened with Wendy's in recent weeks. And, you know, I think one of the things I tried to illustrate with that anecdote is the dangers from a PR perspective of big firms really exploiting dynamic pricing to the maximum ability that they could.
In terms of customers being okay with dynamic pricing, if you get an Uber on New Year's Eve, it's usually going to be really expensive. But that said, you might be happy because you got one,
right?
The fact that there is surge pricing means that there are Uber drivers on the road, whereas it used to be really hard to get cabs on New Year's Eve.
You know, generally, I think implicitly people understand the idea that it is a very convenient service. Yes, they're having to pay more than their sort of like internal benchmark, but they're getting enough value out of it where they want to still make that transaction. And, you know, I think people also understand on some level that yes, when prices are higher, more drivers are incentivized to enter these specific geographies, and that overall makes their ability to get a ride much easier. Similarly, in other markets like Wendy's, I don't think anyone thinks that Wendy's has an inability to provide more food. There's no shortages of burgers. For Wendy's, the incentive is to sort of like optimize on their fixed costs. It's to try and get the most out of the amount of rent that they're paying and to sell even more than they otherwise would. There's another aspect of this, which I think hasn't really been looked at. Let's say you're a competitor to Wendy's, let's say you're McDonald's or Burger King, you know, what do you do in response to dynamic pricing from Wendy's? And there are a couple of different things that could conceivably happen in the world as we move forward and more people try to implement dynamic pricing. And one of the ones that I'm really afraid of, and as someone who's studying antitrust and figuring out how to like break up concentrations of monopoly power, something that I have my eye on, is the use of algorithms to collude amongst competitors. And so, you know, if you think about the classic monopoly, it's like one firm with all the market share and therefore the ability to set prices. But there's another form of monopoly, which is like the cartel version. And, you know, one of the things that happens when you have these really sophisticated algorithms is there's always the ability for the machines to communicate with other machines and sort of converge on pricing that is monopoly-ish. And, you know, you see this all the time, especially like, for example, in the rental market, there are a lot of firms that essentially rent out to normal people in major metro areas that all use the same software called RealPage.
Yeah.
And through the use of this software, they're able to artificially make rents much higher for the median person. And this is the type of thing that I think is really pernicious, which is the use of machines to essentially hide collusion, to make it something that's very difficult for government forces to clamp down on, and therefore like really increase the pricing power of corporations to the detriment of consumers. You know, before LLMs were really famous, there's this famous example of Facebook had sort of created a form of generative AI, mm-hmm. and it had set up this experiment where it was chatting with another version of generative AI within the Facebook corporation. And very quickly, these two bots came up with their own language. And it's something that humans reading the conversation couldn't decipher. They had no idea what was being said, but the conversation kept going and there was clearly some structure to it. And it had its own internal grammar and syntax. And so similarly, when you have these algorithms that are super sophisticated and we pour more and more resources into like optimizing AI bots and all of these things, you know, what happens in a world in which all these AI bots start communicating, colluding, start playing these iterative games where they know that over time, it's in everyone's best interest to collude as opposed to compete? That's the thing that I was really afraid of, and I continue to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are two things that give me a little bit of optimism, one of which I wrote about in the book, and the other of which is a set of ideas I've been developing more recently. And so the first is, I think there is the potential, though, for countervailing consumer-oriented AI. And so what I mean by that is you might have seen this plugin on Google Chrome, which is, I think, called Honey,
yeah.
which sort of scours the internet and tries to find deals for you.
Yeah, gets you the best deals. You know, sometimes they're not that great, but it still finds them. So
right. You could have these tools that are sort of like AI bots that fight for you versus their AI.
Yeah.
And there is sort of a market for that. You know, I met someone named Josh Browder recently who started this company called Do Not Pay. And he's developing these AI bots that essentially will appeal, you know, parking tickets and junk fees on your behalf using AI bots. And so they'll send the email, they'll make the phone call, and this AI bot will basically argue with bureaucrats on your behalf to get you refunds for things that they feel that you could be able to get if you had the time to really go through that super annoying process of calling and waiting and pressing all the numbers to get to the right person. And so I think both of those things are sort of examples of this world in which, you know, technology can fight technology on your behalf. And it sort of brings us back to the bizarre example that we started with, right? It's two people haggling. Now we're going to have two bots on the behalf of two people that will be haggling. And that might sort of levelize the playing field a little bit. And so that's something that I think potentially and hopefully emerges out of something like this. But the second area is when it comes to collusion, the antitrust laws could be made stronger, specifically on this point of algorithms that are to the detriment of consumers. You don't have a bunch of businessmen in a smoke-filled room smoking a cigar. What you have is essentially their bots doing the same thing in a more implicit and abstract manner.
Yeah.
And it's just as bad for consumers. It's much harder to enforce against. And so I think, you know, really not necessarily regulating, but figuring out which firms with how much market power are allowed to use some of these pricing tools could be something that's really positive for consumers.
So then in other words, if we do have a world where dynamic pricing is prevalent, then ideally for consumers, there would be either some tools that allow consumers to have almost as much of a fight in kind of getting these good prices. So we're back to the early days of bartering, or, you know, there's some good regulation set up against the biggest companies. Back when you wrote this book at first in 2018, you said dynamic pricing was going to probably be inevitable. Are we going to be seeing it, you think, at places like Wendy's, at grocery stores, all over the place?
If Wendy's had described this as something else, if they'd said it was, you know, a Frosty special or something like this, that essentially is digitally enabled, I think there would have been way less pushback. And so I think one of the things that we have seen and will continue to see is there's dynamic pricing all the time. There's dynamic pricing on eBay. Increasingly, I think we'll see dynamic pricing in other types of e-commerce shops, whether Shopify or elsewhere. And so it happens all the time. The question is, as we move forward, will people use more and more euphemistic language in order to describe it? If you think about framings like happy hours or lunch specials, These are things that are like feel good framings, but that sort of like give you a narrative that allows you to understand exactly what the business is trying to do and sort of helps you participate in that pricing narrative. And I think in the future, that's increasingly what we're going to see is really sophisticated PR work. I don't think you're going to see another Wendy's. I think everyone's going to look at Wendy's and say, this is exactly what we don't want to do. Just like people looked at Coca-Cola in 1999 and said, this is exactly what we don't want to do. But you still continue to see the proliferation of dynamic pricing throughout the 2000s and beyond. And, you know, I think as compute gets cheaper, it's just going to be too profitable to not implement dynamic pricing, absent some sort of regulatory intervention or absent some sort of bots. I think this could actually be quite dangerous.
Yeah. All right. So if it's not Wendy's, it's going to be somebody else. Sahaj, thank you so much for joining us today. For anyone who wants to read more, his book is The Extinction of the Price Tag, How Dynamic Pricing Can Save You. You can also read all of his writing about antitrust on his Substack, which is called The Muckrake at sahajsharda.substack.com. Thank you again for joining us, Sahaj.
Thanks, Mark. Really excited to be here.
That's going to do it for us today. Thank you everybody for tuning in to the Hustle Daily Show. We're a proud part of the HubSpot Podcast Network. Our editor today is Robert Hartwig and our executive producer is Darren Clark. We've got a lot more tech and business coverage in our newsletter. So if you're not subscribed, please go get signed up at thehustle.co/email and we'll catch you tomorrow.